Hello there, and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 25. This one is about the women in King Solomon's lives. Yes, this one's about King Solomon's wives and concubines, and we read about them in 1 Kings 11, 1-8, which I'll read now. King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the Israelites, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for they will surely incline your heart to follow their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. Among his wives were 700 princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon followed Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not completely follow the Lord, as his father David had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who offered incense and sacrificed to their gods. Now, when we read this today, I think what is so shocking is the fact that when we read verse 3, we skip over it pretty quickly. But verse 3 says, among Solomon's wives were 700 princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And the thought of having 300 concubines and 700 wives seems overwhelming to our society today. Can you imagine if our president of the United States had that kind of harem? How would we react to a leader whose view of women was just simply more? I mean, the idea that one man requires 1,000 sex slaves is one of the most offensive, horrendous, terrible ideas in Scripture. And yet Christianity simply glosses over it. And as we read through this story, we say to ourselves, won't somebody do something about this? Because this is a sin. And so after we read the passage that we just read, we realize that in 1 Kings 11, 9, the very next verse, God shows up and we say, oh good, God's here. And once God sees this kind of injustice happening, then we know that God will put a stop to it. But we read in 1 Kings 11, 9, then the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord. Now, at this point, we have to say, hold up. Why isn't God mad at Solomon for having 700 wives and 300 concubines? Isn't that a bigger sin than God's bruised ego? And yet God sees 1,000 sex slaves, and rather than putting a stop to that, God, according to the text, is more concerned with his fragile ego than with stopping slavery. Why isn't God mad at Solomon for having 1,000 sex slaves? Now, we even know this because if you were to ask Christians, why is it a problem to have 1,000 sex slaves? Most Christians would say, well, it's a problem because we have the Ten Commandments. And the seventh commandment is, quite simply, you shall not commit adultery. Now, these Ten Commandments were given to Moses, including the seventh commandment, and Moses then was considered the great judge of the land. And so if we were to ask Moses, Moses, what do you think of a king who claims to be part of God's people and yet has 700 wives and 300 concubines, do you feel like that's a violation of adultery? Moses would, of course, say, well, that seems like adultery to me. But it doesn't just stop with Solomon, because if you were to look at Solomon's father, David, David had seven wives. Not only that, but we read in 2 Samuel 5 that David took more concubines and more wives after the seven wives. And when we look at David's morality, paralleled or juxtaposed against the Ten Commandments, which say, you shall not commit adultery, and we ask Moses, is this adultery to have seven wives and more concubines? Moses would have to say, well, that seems like adultery to me. But what if we looked beyond David to a great patriarch of the Jewish tradition, a man named Jacob. Jacob loved one sister, a sister named Rachel, and he ended up accidentally marrying the older sister that he did not desire, named Leah. And so Jacob, instead of just saying, well, I have one wife and that's enough because that's what God requires, Jacob has two wives, Leah and Rachel. But it doesn't end there. Because in the story of Jacob, Jacob doesn't just sleep with his wives. He also sleeps with their handmaidens, Bilhah and Zilpah. And when Jacob sleeps with them, whether you agree with the polygamous aspect of this text or not, you have to ask the question, isn't that adultery? Because after all, the text says, you shall not commit adultery. Moses, what do you think? And Moses would look at this story and would have to say, well, that seems like adultery to me. And what if we were to consider the great patriarch, the number one patriarch, a man named Abraham? Abraham had a wife named Sarah. Sarah couldn't get pregnant. God said that she would one day be pregnant, and Abraham, because he's a little anxious, ended up sleeping with Sarah's handmaiden named Hagar. Now, if that's not adultery, I don't know what is. And Moses, I'd have to ask Moses, do you consider that adultery? And Moses would say, well, that seems like adultery to me. And as we look at these great fathers of faith, another father that we'd have to consider is a man named Moses. And Moses at this point would say, what? Because Moses married a woman named Zipporah, but we also read in a book named Numbers that he married a Cushite woman as well. And so Moses had multiple wives. And if we were to ask Moses, does this sound like adultery to you? Moses would say, well, look, I can explain. Here we have five heroes of faith, David, Solomon, Abraham, Jacob, and Moses. And God knows about their infidelity, and in only one case, the story of David and Bathsheba, which we'll talk about in a little bit, only in that case does God get angry at their infidelity. Why doesn't God harshly judge the sexual infidelity of all of these men? Not only that, but another question is raised. Does God endorse polygamy? Because these men had multiple wives, and when God shows up, God doesn't really get angry at the fact that these men take more than one wife. So is God okay with polygamy then? Because if God is, then what does that say about God's view of women? Now, you may say these are ridiculous questions, but in the 19th century, there was a radical reformation within American Christianity. And throughout the country, there were preachers that would stand up with great number and say something along the lines of this: God wanted men to have multiple wives. And at this point, someone in the congregation would say, where'd you get that stupid idea? To which the preacher would respond, well, look at the Bible. Look at the stories of Moses and Abraham and Jacob and David and Solomon. God's design for marriage is for a man to have multiple wives. And the congregation would look at those stories and then say, well, he's not wrong. I mean, it feels wrong. It feels unethical. But at the same time, it's kind of in the Bible. And so when we look at this rule about polygamous wives and what is adultery and what's not adultery and how it's all juxtaposed against this commandment that seems so abundantly clear, you shall not commit adultery, we have to ask the question, why isn't God mad at Solomon, David, Jacob, Moses, and Abraham for all of their sexual infidelity, for all of their sins of adultery? Why doesn't God get angry at them throughout Scripture? Well, the reason is very simple, and yet it's a bit confusing when you first understand it. It's because when we hear the commandment, you shall not commit adultery, throughout the Bible, this rule applies only to women. Only women have the responsibility to stay monogamous to their man. To give you an idea of how this plays out, Exodus 21, which is the chapter right after the Ten Commandments, we read that if a man takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish the food, clothing, or marital rights of the first wife. What the text is basically saying is, yes, it's okay for a man to have multiple wives, but he can't play favorites. Now, as shocking as this is, the more that you study the Bible, what you'll realize is that throughout this book, a woman's sexuality belonged to her husband. However, there is a double standard written in the text because a man's sexuality does not belong to his wife, but a man's sexuality instead belongs to himself. Because a woman throughout the Bible is a man's property. Now, what does this have to do with the seventh commandment, which is you shall not commit adultery? The reason that this rule applied only to women was because of biology. Are there any Maury Povich fans listening to the podcast right now? Yeah, Maury Povich is famous for asking one question. Who is the father? This is the epitome of just high-class television. Maury sits down with a woman who has sleeping with multiple partners, and they argue back and forth and back and forth about who the real father of this real child is. And then on air, Maury Povich reveals the results of a paternity test and looks at one of the guys and says, "You are the father." Which raises an interesting question. Maury is living in 2016. And a question we have to ask Maury is, why don't you mix it up a little bit, show a little equality, and do a show asking who is the mother? Where you'd have women take a maternity test and say, "You are the mother." Wouldn't that be fair? Well, as fair as it would be, there would be no drama in it. Why? Of course, because we know who the mother is, because we see the mother giving birth. There's no mystery because of the biology of who we are. The mother is the one giving birth. And so when we talk about what this meant back in biblical times, back before Maury Povich, back before paternity tests, we realize that the seventh commandment was put in place to protect a man's lineage. That's what it was about. And so the only way they could guarantee that a man was the father of the son that was being born from the woman was if the woman was sexually monogamous with the man. And here's where the double standard happens. Men were free to sleep with whoever they wanted. Why? Because they would know who the father is. But there was always one limit as to who men could not sleep with, and that was another man's wife. And when we look at that story that we talked about earlier, about when God gets really mad at one case of adultery within these five great patriarchs of faith, he gets mad at David in the story of Bathsheba. And the way the story goes is that David is on the rooftop, he's bored, he's looking out over his kingdom, and he sees Bathsheba bathing naked. And he asks who that woman is. And in 2 Samuel 11, the messenger comes back and says, "This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." The reason this line is in the story is because the narrator wants you to know that David knows he's about to commit a terrible sin. What is the sin? David is messing with Uriah's lineage. He is making a grave mistake. If Bathsheba wasn't married to someone else, wasn't married to another man, then David would have slept with her and there would have been no consequence from God. Why? Because David's infidelity was not a sin against the biblical definition of marriage. Now let's look at David's son, a man named Solomon. Solomon has 700 wives and 300 concubines, and the question we ask is, why isn't God mad at Solomon's 1,000 sex slaves? Well, because Solomon's infidelities were not a sin against the biblical definition of marriage. Today, we talk a lot about the biblical definition of marriage. While there are a lot of verses that say a lot of different things about marriage, if you were to sift through the overwhelming majority of the biblical definition of marriage, it would be this. A woman is the property of her husband. She is to remain sexually faithful to her husband alone. Otherwise, she is to be put to death. A man, however, owns his wife, and he may sleep with whoever he desires except a woman who is owned by another man. That is the biblical definition of marriage. And what's important for us to know about what the Bible understands marriage to be is that throughout the Bible, men held women to different sexual ethics than their own in order to protect the patriarchy, in order to protect men being in control, in order to belittle women to the point of property. And if you're listening to this and thinking to yourself, you know, I don't really go to church, and this is why I stopped going to church, this is why I stopped reading the Bible, it felt too sexist, it felt too old, it felt too dated, then I would say to you, yes, you're right. Because if this all sounds extremely dated and sexist, I would like to tell you something. It's because all of this in the Bible is extremely dated and sexist. When a man takes multiple wives, it is always degrading to the women. When a man sees a woman as a piece of property, it is always degrading to the woman. Anytime a marriage is made up of a man who is greater than the woman, it is always a dated and sexist model of marriage. We have to leave that idea behind. Why? Because women are made in the image of God just like men. That's why. Because while men throughout history have projected their own agenda and will onto God to control women, God has somehow persevered to show us that she has made women in her image too. We must leave that behind. The idea of a marriage of unequal partners is a marriage of slavery. Now, while we often look back at the Bible and say, well, that's all dated and sexist, we've moved beyond that, we're in such a modern, gleaming, beautiful society now, I look at what our society is, along with several other feminist activists that know much more about this topic, and say, we still have a long ways to go. Because we so often hold women to different sexual ethics than our own in order to protect the patriarchy. There are three stories that come to my mind that demonstrate this inequality. The first story happened in 2004 during the Super Bowl. Now, you may be a sports fan and remember that the Patriots played the Panthers in 2004, but what everybody remembers this Super Bowl for was the halftime show. The halftime show began with P. Diddy and Nelly rocking the stage, and then shortly after that, Kid Rock came out in an American flag tank top for reasons I don't understand, and then Janet Jackson arrived on the stage and rocked the His House. At the end of Janet Jackson's set, she brought out a surprise guest, none other than Justin Timberlake. And Justin Timberlake began to sing the song, Rock Your Body. And as he's wrapping up the song, he ends the song by saying these words, "Bet I'll have you naked by the end of this song." At that point, we didn't know that Justin Timberlake was talking in literal terms. After singing that line, Timberlake then reached over, grabbed Janet Jackson's chest and ripped off her clothing, exposing her bare breast to 20 million viewers for 9/16 of a second. Janet Jackson was mortified. She quickly left the arena, and people tried to contact her. But Jackson's spokesperson called the reveal a malfunction of the wardrobe. It was not intentional. Timberlake was supposed to pull away the bustier and leave the red lace bra. But what happened after that story was really interesting. Because a week later, CBS, which televised the Super Bowl, was also set to televise the Grammys. And one of the presenters at the Grammys was to be Janet Jackson. However, after the Super Bowl halftime ordeal, CBS called Janet Jackson and rescinded their invitation to her. She was not allowed to come to the Grammys. However, Justin Timberlake still had an invitation to attend the Grammys. And not only that, but he won 2 awards and was allowed to make 2 acceptance speeches. During one of the speeches, he said, "I'm sorry for the unintentional accident." 2 years later, while in an interview with MTV, Justin Timberlake said, "Look, I probably got 10% of the blame. I think America is harsher on women. I think America is unfairly harsh on ethnic people." 10 years after that Super Bowl show, the FCC chairman in 2004, Michael Powell, the person who's supposed to be in charge from preventing the Janet Jackson fiasco from happening, said this in an interview with ESPN.com on the decade anniversary. He said, "I personally thought that the way that we, the FCC, treated Janet Jackson was really unfair. It all turned into being about her. In reality, if you slow the thing down, it's Justin ripping off her breastplate." So when it comes to the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show, we could argue and argue and argue about who is innocent and who is guilty, who is right and who is wrong. But what is hard to argue, or what is hard to ignore, is who received the majority of the blame. And over 10 years later, we have all of these men saying, "Yes, we pointed the finger at the woman and she was the problem and it was wrong." And what the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show reveals is that men are still holding women to different sexual ethics than their own. Why? To protect the patriarchy. We are still living in a society that when a sexual sin happens, men will quickly point the finger at the woman, say it's her fault, and our society, we as a whole, will look at it and say, "Yep, it's her problem." We blame her. Why? Because we don't want to blame the man. We'll blame the woman, even though they're equally involved. The second story I'd like to talk to you about is a story of a man named Bill Clinton, who was sworn into office as President of the United States in 1993. A year later, in 1994, a woman named Paula Jones filed a lawsuit against President Clinton. Paula Jones used to work at the Arkansas Capitol building where Bill Clinton was the governor, and she said that while he was governor, he had propositioned her for sex. And so an investigation was launched to see if the President of the United States, when he was governor, had indeed done what Paula Jones claimed he had done. The next year after that, in 1995, the White House hired an intern named Monica Lewinsky. A few years after that, Bill Clinton was answering questions in a deposition under oath about the Paula Jones case. And on that same day, the Drudge Report, an internet news source, released a story that Bill Clinton had been having sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky. Not only that, but the Drudge Report released information that Bill Clinton was being asked about his involvement with Monica Lewinsky to see if this was a pattern with his power. And during this deposition, they asked President Clinton, "Have you ever been involved with Monica Lewinsky?" And he answered under oath, "I have never had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky." 9 days later, on January 26, Bill Clinton was speaking in public with cameras rolling, and he looked right into the lens of the camera and said these words, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky." And then 7 months later, Bill Clinton was once again looking into the lens of a camera and saying a very different story. He said on August 17, 1998, "As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong." Bill Clinton then encouraged the American people to move on from this distraction so they could get back to the business of being the United States of America. Bill Clinton was impeached for his alleged perjury, but the House of Representatives felt this was not deserving of a removal of office. And Bill Clinton continued to be the President of the United States of America. Now, Clinton did receive a $90,000 fine for misleading testimony. He also settled out of court with Paula Jones for $850,000, and his license to practice law in Arkansas was suspended for 5 years. But other than that, he's kind of moved on. And what happened to Miss Lewinsky? Well, she disappeared for a while. She took a break. She was trying to reconcile her life and ask the question, "What do I do now?" And just last year, in 2015, she gave a TED Talk that I personally found to be inspirational. She talked about the harmful effects of cyberbullying. And while she was talking about cyberbullying, she talked about what happened back in 1995 when she did have relations with the President of the United States of America. She said, "At the age of 22, I fell in love with my boss. And at the age of 24, I learned the devastating consequences. Not a day goes by that I am not reminded of my mistake. And I regret that mistake deeply." No matter where she goes, she is reminded of the Bill Clinton scandal. Now, the question I have to ask you is this: who should receive the majority of the blame for this scandal? Should it be the President of the United States of America or the intern? Should it be the man with the power or the woman who is employed by the power? It's important for us to ask who should receive the blame, but then we ask the question, but who did receive the majority of the blame? Without a doubt, Monica Lewinsky received the majority of the blame. Bill Clinton, the one with all the power, the one who is the man, the one who is part of the patriarchy, has been able to move on and transcend this sin. Meanwhile, Monica Lewinsky, the woman in this scandal, has said she is sorry, has asked for forgiveness. And the number one thing that we think of when we see her is, oh, that woman, the woman in the scandal. You see, the Bill Clinton scandal reveals that men are still holding women to different sexual ethics than their own in order to protect the patriarchy. I'd like to share one more story that reveals this double standard in our society today. The story is about a basketball player named Kobe Bryant. And Kobe Bryant, in July of 2003, was arrested for sexual assault in a hotel in Eagle, Colorado. After he posted bail, he held a press conference on July 18 where he said these words next to his wife, Vanessa. He said, "I didn't force the victim to do anything against her will. I sit here in front of you guys furious with myself for making the mistake of adultery. I love my wife with all my heart." Now, over the past year, we spent a lot of time reminiscing about Kobe Bryant because this was his last year. And while he had a great basketball career and we remembered all the highlights of his wonderful athletic ability, I felt like very few people wanted to talk about what happened in 2003. It was almost like people completely forgot about the fact that he was accused of sexual assault. But there was one journalist I read, a woman named Robin Abkarian, who wrote for the Los Angeles Times in December, in the midst of Kobe mania, about the sexual assault scandal in 2003. She wrote an article entitled, "As We Celebrate Kobe Bryant's Career, We Should Remember, Too, Its Darkest Chapter." And in there she said, "I won't be sad to see him go." She also wrote, "Just days before a trial that could have put Bryant away for a long time had he been found guilty, the accuser said she would not testify. She had then filed a civil suit, later settled confidentially. Prosecutors then dropped the charge. Bryant fans rejoiced. Didn't that prove the rape allegation was unfounded after all?" Well, she writes, "The Bryant assault case proved that a young woman should never expect the criminal justice system to work for her if her alleged assailant is a rich, famous, and beloved American celebrity. And I would say a beloved male celebrity." From there, Robin Abkarian talks about some of the horrors, the sins, the illegal things that happened within this court case that forced this woman not to testify. She talks about how the victim's full name was mistakenly published 3 times on the Eagle County website. Not only that, but a court reporter accidentally emailed transcripts of a closed hearing about the victim's sexual activity to 7 news organizations. This was supposed to be confidential. Not only that, but in one hearing, Bryant's attorney, violating the Shield Law of Colorado, repeatedly stated the accuser's name. Not only that, but there were also 3 men who offered Bryant's bodyguards $1 million to kill the victim. Here was a victim whose life was transformed by the assault, and yet here is Kobe Bryant on the other end giving this press conference where he talks about how much he loves his wife, and then 2 weeks after that conference, he was on the stage at the Teen Choice Awards for winning Male Athlete of the Year. Whose life was defined by this assault? Was it the man? Or was it the woman? You see, the Kobe Bryant sexual assault case reveals that men are still holding women to different sexual ethics. Why? To protect the patriarchy. Because when sexual assault scandals happen, we, our society, point the finger at the woman and say it must be her problem. We do this over and over and over again. We as a society must become better. We must hold the same sexual ethics across genders. Our society needs to be much more aware of how often we default to blaming the woman in sexual ethics. And for how to get better, I'd like to propose that we use the Bible. Yes, the Bible, the book that we earlier talked about as being dated and sexist. Because when we talk about how Christians understand the Bible, there is a great misunderstanding that leads to Christians becoming dated and sexist. And yet that's not the story of the Bible. So how do Christians become dated and sexist? Well, it's all in the way that we understand the Bible. So the way that Christians understand the Bible is that God spoke every word to the authors of the Bible. In other words, the words of the Bible descended from heaven, perfect and infallible. Now, these words were to stand as a rule or a law for all time, before the Bible was written and after the Bible was written. And so we understand this Bible to be the perfect, unchallengeable, infallible law. But the truth is, this reveals a static and closed understanding of God. Because if it's perfect, then there's nothing more to add. And therefore, God has nothing more to say. And so after the Bible is written, God becomes more distant. But you can call me old-fashioned, but I believe in a God who is very close and very near to all of us. And because of that, I don't believe in the static and closed law of God. I believe in the dynamic and expansive law of God. And if you're to look at how the Bible is written, beginning with Genesis and ending with Revelation, you have to understand that the story of the Bible begins where women are the property of men. And then as the Bible is written from generation to generation to generation, you can see as women's rights start to unfold throughout the Bible, how it gets better and better with each chapter that goes by. Until eventually we get to the very first book that is written in the New Testament, the book of Galatians, where a guy named Paul sits down and writes these words. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male or female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And Paul stands up and says, oh, no, women are not the property of men. Women are equal with men. Here's what's so beautiful about the Bible. The Bible begins with a misunderstanding or a sin against women. Namely, the Bible views women as the property of men. But before the story is over, Paul has the audacity to say, you know, I think we've been getting this wrong, and it is open to the dynamic and expansive law of God that God has something more than what we started with. And because of this, Paul said, you know, there's more to the Bible than just the Bible. I think that women are equal with men. Now, at this point, contemporaries of Paul, people living in the same day as Paul, would look at him and say, where did you get that crazy idea? And Paul would say, I got it from my belief in Jesus Christ, who shows no favorites. Paul eventually dies. The Bible is eventually closed. And yet the dynamic and expansive law of God continued to grow. So because of that, what that challenges Christians to do is to recognize that there is more to learn about God than the Bible can offer. Yes, the Bible is an amazing tool. Yes, the Bible is an amazing book. Yes, the Bible is inspired, but there is more to God than what is found on its pages. And because of that, we should recognize this pattern of Scripture, how women start as the property of men and end up being equal with men, and realize there is more for us to do. You see, I believe that Christians should be at the forefront of gender equality. Christians should not be the ones dragging us back to a biblical definition of marriage. Why? Because the biblical definition of marriage is a sin. The idea that women are inferior to men. Christians should be at the forefront of gender equality. Christians should be pushing the state to more inclusion and acceptance of equal rights for men and women. That is the story of the Bible. That's what it's about. And when we ask the question, why didn't God call out Solomon for his 1,000 sex slaves? It's because the Bible was written by men, men who were concerned with protecting the patriarchy. Paul was a different kind of person. Paul was not concerned with preserving the patriarchy. Paul was concerned with the equality of God's children. And we are called to follow in Paul's footsteps because Paul followed in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. Christians should be at the forefront of gender equality. That is our challenge for women's rights throughout the Bible. May we fight for the equality of men and women everywhere. Grace and peace to you.